Whole Package Cash, a semi-monthly news and discussion show about the world of DB2. Thanks for joining us again for the finest DB2 podcast in all of Westeros. Today is May 26th, 2014, and this is episode number 16. The show is hosted by me, Ian Bjerhovda, and my co-host, Fred Sabatka. Hey, Fred.
How's it going, Ian?
Good. How you doing, man?
Doing great. It's a nice 60-something degrees up here, back in Portland.
Yeah? Have you recovered from the week of scorpions in Phoenix?
Yeah, I expected more scorpions, and I was trying to make sure that the IDUG attendees took that scorpion threat seriously, but apparently no one got hurt, and that was good, so everyone was safe from scorpions.
Yeah, I have to really commend the Sheraton for doing a good job of keeping the second and third floors clear of scorpions.
Right, right. Yeah, it all depends on what floor you're on.
I didn't even see any in the garage, so.
They're tricky.
Yeah, that's how those scorpions are. But yeah, so IDUG, it was a quite successful conference yet again.
I was thrilled that it was in Phoenix. I think it was not the first time it's been in Phoenix, but it has been a long time. We've been bouncing back and forth between IDUG in Florida and IDUG in Denver with only a couple of variations. So this was a really nice change of pace.
Yeah, I don't remember it ever being here, but it's been, I don't know, I guess I can only remember about 15 years. So
yeah, the statute of limitations was up, so it was good for them to return. And maybe this will spur a new circuit of cities that IDUG can rotate between, hopefully make it up to Portland sometime.
Yeah, and the weather was really fantastic. It was below average temperatures for the whole week until I think Friday was warm, but man, it was nice.
Yeah, it was decent. And I was talking to a few attendees, especially from Europe, who are just so darn active and ambitious. And we're talking about different trips they were going on to either hike something or take a long drive or go read the tail numbers off of airplanes at the business airport. So definitely good weather for all that.
Yeah, that's for sure. So the opening keynote was great. It featured this guy, Vladimir Bogvansky, who I've seen speak before, and he actually drew his slides, which was just beyond exciting to me to see that someone would actually have the gumption to do that in front of a 600-person audience.
Yeah, it's pretty aggressive.
Yeah, and he was a pro. He brought the audience in, got some big laughs pretty quickly, and then even when his laptop completely froze, he kept his cool. He continued to present while his laptop just restarted and went back to drawing his slides like nothing had happened.
Yeah, and that's good to see the spreading out of topics at IDUG. We've tended to stay focused on DB2 at the keynote, you know, where it's going and what's happening. And then for a while there was a bit of expansion to other IBM tools that they could safely endorse to something that's a bit more outside of the main topic thread. We had Chad Fowler that one year talk about outsourcing and the challenges it presents and opportunities it presents. And then also, I think Vladimir is another one of those that if you were looking for something to broaden your information, then it was a good keynote.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I think that about halfway through, he started getting pretty technical, which I think for the LUW crowd may have not been so far off. But for the Z people I saw, I wondered if a couple of them were losing interest.
It's expected that people are going to be open to a certain extent. But when you start to get out in the weeds, you could lose a few people.
Yeah, although, I mean, didn't IBM just announce Hadoop for the mainframe?
Why not?
So who knows? Maybe they could have picked some stuff up that was useful for them.
Does that mean you have to have three mainframes to store the three copies of your Hadoop data? Is that how it works? So that, because that'd be pretty cool if you know we're selling mainframes to get everyone on that triple or quadruple setup.
Come on, let's get a cluster of Z10 or Z11. What are they? Z12 now? I don't even know.
Z12, Z13, whatever it takes.
Yeah, I'll just order 50 of those, and then I can have my nice Hadoop cluster.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that presentation was good. Donald Feinberg, he had a keynote on Thursday afternoon, and he didn't talk much about DB2 either. He was talking about big data.
That's probably for the best, because you are dealing with a lot of expert presenters, both from the user side, consultants, and then also from the IBM side. So I kind of like the new approach of not so much DB2 content for the keynotes, you know, the all hands keynotes. So I liked Donald's kind of curmudgeonly take. He does work for Gartner, so he has access to the Gartner hype cycle that they made famous. So, but he made an interesting point that the hype cycle doesn't always flow back up to that plateau. You could crash hard in the backlash phase. And then he says there's a little magical trap door that sometimes opens. And if you crash hard enough, you'll fall through that trap door and you'll never make it out. And he thinks that big data is likely to suffer that fate. Not necessarily the Hadoop part. He thinks Hadoop's got some future to it because it's fairly versatile. But the whole big data buzzword, he sees that potentially just crashing through the floor, never to be seen again once the backlash is in full effect.
That was a pretty ballsy comment to make.
Well, he's hanging out in Brazil. You know, I think he sees some real intense stuff going on over there. So to go fly up to Phoenix and or wherever else he's invited to speak and be a bit brash and curmudgeonly is probably nothing compared to the intensity of what he faces just getting around town back home.
Yeah. So did you have any sessions that you thought were particularly good of the normal technical sessions?
Yeah, I liked catching up on Matt Hurus's session. I had to attend some volunteer meetings and also some client calls, so I didn't get to attend every session. And had some great conversations outside of some of these rooms with colleagues, which is part of the whole iDug experience. The interesting one from a gentleman from Finland about capturing the deltas for a lot of performance time data. This is a classic problem for DB2 monitoring because you have all these counters and then you want to figure out when things are changing. So he came up with an approach that didn't exploit time travel query, but created these schemas that were generated and each schema was set to a certain delta value. So a schema of the past hour or a schema of the past week or whatever. So it was really novel.
Was that done with views or was that done as physical tables with data getting copied?
It was done with views. So it was an interesting approach and I was curious if he would adjust it much for at least system time temporal for the things that it offers. But so I'd say that was one of the more unusual sessions I've attended there. And thought-provoking.
Yeah, it's always nice. I mean, I think that people look at these conferences and they see all these amazing IBM speakers or amazing consultant speakers or, you know, whatever, well-known speakers. And it's easy to sometimes look at the grid and see a Matt Hurus or Terry Purcell and see a user speaker next to it. And you say, oh, well, I'm going to go to the big-name speaker. But, man, sometimes you miss real gems.
Yeah. And I think also you've got to take into account the fact that these more polished IBM speakers, and we said this before, their slides might be adequate to the point where if you can only be in one place at one time and you don't have colleagues or clones to attend the other sessions in parallel, you might be better off going to the user speaker who might be a first or second time speaker and really sit in their session and soak it in versus trying to suss out from their slides afterward what they might have talked about.
Right. Well, I am looking forward. The content committee from iDug, I know they planned to tape 6 or 7 different talks during the conference to be released on iDug.org at some point over the next few months. So I'm looking forward to see how that turns out.
Well, I recklessly volunteered to help with that. So I'll probably be one of the guys scraping through these different video formats and cleaning up audio files and maybe synchronizing some slides and whatnot. So if it happens and it's good, then I was definitely involved.
Okay, I'll try to remember that. During one of the panel discussions for LUW, there's something that just caught me totally off guard. Waleed Erjabi, hopefully I got that right, was talking about encryption. And obviously, with all the talk about data breaches, there's been a lot of thought about that. And it sounds like IBM is in the process of developing, or they have developed, a encryption solution for DB2 that's built into the engine, which sounds totally awesome. And what's amazing to me, and this is the part that really surprised me, is that this functionality is available in the Blue for Cloud beta, but it isn't in the schedule to be released yet in the normal code base. And so that was really surprising to me for two reasons. One, it's not scheduled, because who wouldn't want that? And two, that we're now seeing stuff that's in development coming out in Blue for Cloud ahead of the normal code base.
Yeah, that is some new territory. I wonder also if, even if the products stay locked to that same common code base, if they're still going to have that differentiation on their cloud offering just to make it attractive for different reasons. Because I could see them perhaps making certain features on Blue for Cloud available just so that it has some extra pull, versus making everything available in on-premises versions of DB2 as well.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, I think that with cloud, people are more concerned than normal with the security of their data. I remember Leon Katznelson having a really interesting presentation about that and just talking about chances are if you're storing data in the cloud, it's more secure than in your own data center. But that aside, there's still that perception of your data is somewhere out there that you don't have physical control over. So adding that encryption is almost a necessity. But I guess I would just expect that customers would be begging for that already, even if it's in their own data center. And so Waleed put out a question to the audience from the panel saying, if this is interesting, please send me an email and tell me that this is something that you want, so he can use that as ammunition to get it in the main code base.
That's very admirable that he did that. And that's part of the great experience of going to a conference, is the potential that you as a customer, or at least a user, can influence significantly the direction of the product. He could have also just asked everyone to raise their hands and then taken a picture of that to take back to his manager or the product team. But I guess a bunch of emails from actual people who will go on record saying they want it would probably be better.
Yeah, perhaps. So it was funny, in our pre-iDug episode, I talked about Adam Storm's presentations, and for some reason I managed to link to the wrong presentation. So I was really excited about going to this Blue one, and he had a second presentation just talking about cool tricks for DB2, which is the one that I linked to. So I ended up going to both, and they were of course both good, but in the top five tricks for DB2, it was pretty funny. He he walked through a scenario of how you can take out revenge or extract revenge on your office mates using WLM. And even though he claimed that this isn't the kind of shenanigans that they play in the lab, somehow I'm not sure I believe that.
So he basically found a way to weaponize WLM.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly what it was. It was awesome.
It's already kind of a blunt and intimidating weapon before you start using it for nefarious purposes.
Yeah, I mean, and even going to the point of explaining how you can cover your tracks.
Nice.
So it was fun. He's a great speaker, and that was a lot of fun in that session.
And he's been part of some very high-profile parts of DB2LUW over the years, too. So I like where he tends to be located in the product development process, so that not only is he an engaging speaker, but he's actually talking about stuff that I tend to use except for the weaponized WLM. But who knows? You know, I might just decide to spend my holiday weekend digging into that.
There you go. Did you end up taking notes during the sessions that you made it to?
Somewhat, yeah. I did download a lot of PDFs to my tablet, and those were fairly complete. So I wasn't under as much pressure to do that. And for some of the more strategic talks, I was able to just jot down a couple of basic concepts about where people thought the industry was going without really going down this blow by blow account of what was being discussed.
So did you end up doing it on paper or?
Some on paper. And then I fell out of that ambitious phase and went more to this semi-ridiculous tablet with a Bluetooth keyboard kind of rig that had me crossing my legs and putting a little desktop setup on my lap so I'm typing, but not as loudly and annoying as your typical laptop user in a conference. I was trying to be polite.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up because one of the things when we were talking about the whole idea of retention and making notes on paper versus using a computer, that reminded me of this thing called Sketch Notes, where this guy, Mike Rowe, is that his name? He basically draws out kind of artistically the notes that he's taking. And again, it was that same kind of thing where when you do that, your retention goes way up.
Yeah, I dug into the concept a little bit, and it seems a bit intimidating to me that I can barely write legibly just as words, and this dude is drawing, rendering typography in his sketchbook of what's being said. It just seems like it would be flying by way too fast for me to come up with anything that didn't look like a crime scene.
Yeah, I've tried doing that once or twice and trying to, I don't know, it's like, it's very hard to get what's going on and figure out, you know, in real time what the really big points are that you would spend more time drawing than some of the less important stuff.
I think this also falls into that category of the real difference between technical conferences like IDUG and Insight, formerly IOD, that they are walking through fairly involved technical material and intricate processes, whereas the stuff that we're seeing on TED, and not to denigrate it at all, I mean, there are some great talks in various conference formats, they're talking more about ideas and a worldview and philosophies that might be easier to sketch out as you're hearing it and get ideas and put them on the paper in the way that they impacted you. And a lot of the conferences that are valuable to me as an IDUG attendee don't really flow that way. They're more like high-level university lectures in a good way. And I don't know what my sketches would necessarily look like from one of those talks or if they would be useful rather than me saying, don't forget to do this and remember this and kind of a laundry list approach versus this rendering of concepts into word art.
Yeah, I guess it probably depends. I mean, if you take a session like Guy Lohman's Blue Internals talk. I mean, granted, there is a lot of low-level technical detail in that, but it still kind of flowed along that whole seven big ideas thing that IBM has been talking about with Blue. And so, you know, maybe you can leverage some of that, or you have some at least advanced knowledge of what the topics are going to be and what the high points are going to be. So maybe you could focus on that.
Yeah. I'm not against it, but I don't think anyone's ever going to want to see my sketches anytime soon.
Well, so speaking of Guy Lohman's talk, I have never heard someone describe how you do hash joins so well. I mean, that was really easy to understand.
Yeah. The guy is an inspiring character. He worked for NASA before IBM. The dude knows his stuff. And I was a bit starstruck when we managed to corral him into our package cache pizza party during the night of the dine around and just talked to him about the history of some of these DB2 concepts and also concepts that even predated DB2. And he's just happy to kind of walk through it, even though it's old news for him.
Well, yeah, but you take someone who's got that much brain power, and for him to be able to describe it in such normal language is really impressive.
I asked him a question about a lot of the tactical use of patents, because as we know, IBM is the world's most prolific patenter, and their competitors are creeping up on them. And I thought, are the use of patents, especially as preemptive strategies, hurting the ability for these companies to continue to innovate in their own directions? And he said his take on it was that it's basically at this mutually assured destruction phase, that every major player, at least major player, have licensed enough patents to have their arsenal that is more about preventing a lot of these skirmishes than about actually hoarding any IP. And he made an example of a company that recently purchased some patents from IBM. And he looked at the list and it didn't seem that germane to what the company was doing, but it still served their purpose of buying a big enough arsenal that people are less likely to mess around with you. So guy tried to convince me that everyone's got their patents and there's licensing agreements for just about everything that's significant. So if someone's got a patent on a big part of what they use, others will be able to license it and continue to compete. That's how I portrayed it. And I can't say I doubt him, because we're seeing a lot of movement by different competitors in the same arena featuring a lot of the same features. And you know full well that only one company is going to be able to patent some of these concepts at a time. So despite all these patents being around and more stuff getting patented every year, these companies can still come up with, hey, we're doing in-memory as well. Oh, we're doing column-oriented as well. And we're doing whatever, graph stores or you name it, or clustering. So that seemed a bit encouraging compared to what I was thinking before.
That's interesting. That's a little scary, though, I think. I mean, the whole patent super weapon kind of idea doesn't bode well for the smaller developers, right? I mean, if there's some small guy, and I think of Mike Stonebreaker.
Yeah.
You know, how does that bode for someone like that who, you know, he starts some startup company like Vertica or whatever his new one is, and someone else can just, you know, come in and accuse him of some kind of patent violation. And as a small company, he doesn't necessarily have the resources to defend that, because I mean, a big patent lawsuit case could be millions and millions of dollars just to defend it.
Yeah. I don't have the answers there. I mean, hopefully if you're in the game at all and you're inventing things, and it seems like you can patent pretty much anything. So maybe you'll come up with enough patents to get yourself started, and then you license them, and then you kind of get in the club. And even though your arsenal isn't as big as your competitors, you still have something so that you're in that nuclear patent club. I agree. It's not a feasible strategy for everyone, and it might put some pressure on some folks who would otherwise have a chance at creating something. But I don't know how much of it is just that, because there's so many things you have to get right before you can even develop something that's even got the attention of the larger players. Mm.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I'm not a big fan of software patents at all, but we shall see what happens.
Yeah, and it was just good to get the I appreciated getting the insight of someone who's fairly deeply involved with it. I mean, Guy is one of those massive dudes at IBM who's just invented a ton of stuff over the years and is still out on the forefront. So it was cool to get his point of view.
Yeah, that's really awesome. It was pretty cool, though. We went and had that dinner over at Pizzeria Bianco, who we had expressed some surprise that iDoug was able to get that restaurant for the dine around, just given that it's so small. And sure enough, I think on Monday during the conference, it came out that Pizzeria Bianco had backed out of hosting that event.
No surprise, especially probably as the weather forecast came in and it was not going to be oppressively hot.
Right.
They had a chance of filling it with regular folks. So we jumped on that opportunity, being the shrewd mercenaries that we are here at the Package Cache, and hosted our own inaugural Package Cache dine around with a lot of our friends and fellow Package Cache podcast listeners, mostly from the Toronto lab, and had a great time getting bitten by a couple mosquitoes and having some wonderful pizza.
That was great. So, that was iDoug. It was announced that iDoug next year is going to be in Philadelphia, although that sounds a little bit like a stretch because it's actually right on the edge of Valley Forge, which is about 20 miles west of Philadelphia.
I'm excited about seeing iDoug in a new city that's not Tampa, Orlando, or Denver, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, in the Northeast. I don't know when the last time iDoug was up in the Northeast, so this is exciting.
Yeah, it can get really expensive up there, so I can see Philadelphia being a bit more affordable than, say, Boston or New York.
Right. So, this last week, I saw that IBM had started the process of releasing a new fix pack. It was Fix Pack 4 for DB2.10.1, and I think that came out officially on Thursday.
Yeah, that's been a while. I've been waiting for one APAR to get fixed that kind of took my customer by surprise.
Yeah, I think it was almost 7 months since the last DB2.10.1 Fix Pack.
Yeah, at least. It's been a while.
Yeah, I saw just recently a DB2 user from Colombia named Andres Gomez Casanova. He's been posting all kinds of awesome DB2 utilities and putting them up on GitHub. But he just put up a blog post that catalogs release dates of pretty much all DB2 fix packs since DB2.9.5. And what was interesting is in 10.1, and I hadn't even realized this, but 10.1 Fix Pack 3 was released 7 months ago, but Fix Pack 2 had been 9 months prior to that.
Wow.
So even though 10.5 came out in the midst of all this, the Fix Packs for 10.1 have been few and far between.
No, and it shows because the list of APARs fixed in Fix Pack 4 is pretty long. So there's been some real crazy work to get these improvements and fixes put in. So I'm ready to just grab it down and at least put it on dev, because who knows if they'll put out the oops on Fix Pack 4 and say, well, really, you want Fix Pack 4A or Fix Pack 4B or whatever. So, but I'm definitely eager to try it out.
Somehow I suspect after that 10.5 Fix Pack 3 debacle, we won't see that happen again.
Well, at least as of this recording right now, things are still settling online. We're seeing some of the associated pages still aren't fully updated. So hopefully that just means that we're seeing it when it's brand spanking new and still in the incubator versus about to be yanked and replaced by something else.
Right. Well, one thing that was interesting about it is, now it's Memorial Day weekend here in the United States, so it's a 3-day weekend and a lot of people are not working.
Except the Canadians. They are still chugging along, and I guess they put it out last week and figured, you think maybe just trying to slip it in or something?
I don't know. On Sunday, yesterday, there was a couple of items published on the IBM site about security APARs that were fixed in Fix Pack 4. And a couple of them were kind of nasty and resulted in a new version of Fix Pack 3 for 10.1, as well as Fix Pack 9A for DB2.9.7 and Fix Pack 3A for DB2.10.5. So I think it's great that they're adding all those patches in for all the different versions that it applies to, but kind of funny that they waited until Sunday on a long weekend to release that note.
Yeah. Like there's this whole press corps waiting to pounce on awkward fix pack news that, and they're like asleep at the switch or something over the weekend.
Are we that awkward press corps?
I guess so, but it looks good. There's IP version 6 support for HADR with DB2 Haiku. There's also what they're saying is NIST SP800-131A enhanced encryption compliance. So that's cool. If you aren't having enough challenges just getting DB2 running solidly in your shop, you can throw this whole encryption challenge on there and give yourself a lot of work to do.
Yeah. So how aggressive are you at applying fix packs when there are big, nasty security APARs?
I haven't seen any security APARs that have jumped out enough that it's changed my customers' patching schedule. We take each patch and run it through the QA cycle, whether or not it's just chock full of security fixes or not.
One of my customers is extremely aggressive about applying patches to the systems. So when it comes to operating system patches, and we're talking whether this is Windows or AIX or whatever, there is a monthly schedule and stuff is patched every month, no matter what. But for DB2, we're not as aggressive at doing that. And part of that is just being conservative about changing the database code, because we're not just applying a security patch. We're applying the security patch plus perhaps 500 other fixes. So
right.
There's some reticence to just do that every 3 months or fairly quickly after each fix pack comes out. So it just made me wonder on how other customers do that. If they've gotten more aggressive that you've seen in terms of getting those fix packs applied more quickly, or if it's still kind of business as usual.
I do see differences in philosophy between patching the OS and other components versus patching DB2. That's definitely the case. I think a lot of it comes down to the way these other layers tend to be more piecemeal in their patches, so you can just put on one little thing, kind of the way PTFs are applied to DB2 on the mainframe. With these monolithic DB2 fix packs for LUW, unless you're getting a hot fix for a specific problem you're having with LUW, it's a much bigger ordeal to validate an entire fix pack. Not as much as it used to be when the fix packs were also full of new features that could be disruptive to your applications. But still, you're looking at a fix pack that has dozens of, or even hundreds of fixes. And how many of them are actually applied to you? I could see that being something that doesn't put you in as much of a rush as, say, a patch from Red Hat or a patch from Microsoft that is very targeted to a specific thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess you could go to the lab and say, hey, I want this security patch for DB2.9.7 Fix Pack 7, right? And they could build a hot fix for you. But I am not sure that I would really want to be doing that, just because with hot fixes, those clearly aren't tested in the same level, with the same level of rigor as a normal fix pack.
Well, and even if they are, I have confidence that if you're dealing with IBM support on a specific issue and it's affecting your business to the point where you need a hotfix, I'll give IBM the benefit of the doubt and say that they can put out a hotfix that actually fixes that problem. My concern is more about being now on this weird track of you're so unique now that you have this non-standard environment with DB2. So you can't just put fixed packs on, or you have to decide if the fixed packs actually will hurt or help your environment based on the hot fixes that you've already applied. So it's not a good position to be in. I mean, you always want to be running with the herd when it comes to a commercial database engine. You don't want to be off on the fringe, and running a hot fixed implementation definitely puts you in that marginal category. Not necessarily from a software quality standpoint, because it's, let's say that this single hot fix is validated, but you start piling on these hot fixes, and then you have to replicate your production environment to test and dev and all this stuff. And it can be easy to fall out of sync. So it's hard enough just to get DevOps folks to put the right level of fix pack on their environment so that their code behaves the same. So now if you're telling in some shops, a developer, oh, yeah, you're going to install your DB2 with these scripts, and then also, oh, you got to get these hot fixes down to solve these specific problems that we're dealing with. That's a lot of complexity, and it's just bound to fall apart somewhere. Someone's going to drop the ball, and you're going to be in an awkward situation because you're in this limbo of not quite on one fix pack or the other.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough thing to figure out how to handle. I mean, and especially just security at the database level is a hot button.
Yeah, it's something that I'd rather just see the database buried so deep down in the most secure zone of the network that a lot of the more standard security issues don't even really apply at that point. And I guess that's kind of vague, but and it might sound like a cop out, but I think there are ways to mitigate the risks, certain security risks for a database that you don't have to deal with, say, when you're dealing with a web server or an application server. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can, there are liberties you can take with a database server in terms of security that might give you more options and a more attractive implementation path.
Yeah. And I suppose that, you know, if you've got decent intrusion detection systems running or auditing stuff running in your database, that is really that big way to mitigate those problems.
Yeah. But it's a risky area to talk about with a lot of confidence, because sure enough, some implementation is just going to get plundered, and like eBay was recently, and their database wound up in who knows whose hands. And now we're all getting password reset messages because somebody grabbed a big bleeding chunk of that database. And it's not like eBay doesn't know or care about security. I mean, they devote a lot of effort to it. So it's definitely possible, may not be probable, for some of these bigger shops to get plundered like that, but definitely possible.
Right. Wouldn't it be ironic if the people who stole eBay's database stuff were auctioning off that information on eBay?
Yeah. And you can also, you're getting an envelope, and in this envelope for free is an SD card with 10 million encrypted eBay passwords. But you're not paying for the passwords. That would be illegal. But you're paying for the envelope that happens to contain some passwords.
All right. Well, with that, I don't have anything else for this week. Do you?
No, I'm just happy to enjoy my summer and more DB2.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. You can find me on Twitter at IDBJORH, and Fred is DB2Fred. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please rate us or leave feedback for us in iTunes. The show notes, along with links for everything that we talked about in this episode, are available at packagecache.com/16, along with links to contact us or email us or subscribe to the show. So, with that, we will see you next time.
Later.